Michael B. Jordan cried during Sinners. He cried making the movie. He cried watching Armageddon. He cried watching an anime. At this point, his tear ducts have a resume. We live in a world where an actor's ability to hydrate on cue is headline chemistry. When most people cry, it's because a loved one died, the rent is due, or the coffee machine commits murder. When a Hollywood leading man cries, we file it under performance art, put a bow on it, and nominate it for a trophy. His co-star says she could tell which twin he was with her back turned. Magnetism, cadence, dimples, the great detective work of our era. Identifying characters by facial topography while pretending this is not the sort of thing we spend time parsing during dinner. We have podcasts arguing whether Stack's dimples are method acting. At some point, the only unresolved global conflict left is which cheek raises first. He's up for a Golden Globe, an industry award that essentially says, congratulations, your sorrow was convincing. Meanwhile, real sorrow is still waiting for an RSVP. This is the peculiar economy of feelings and late-stage privilege. Vulnerability is currency if it comes with press photos. Authentic grief is news if packaged between interviews about mentors and blockbuster tearjerkers. Fans cheer when an actor gets moved by a disaster movie. Armageddon, the film that taught us you can solve global catastrophe with one drill bit and several slow-motion hugs, and then treat those tears like proof of moral fiber. There's something absurd about evaluating humanity by its ability to cry on cue, and even more absurd about debating whether those tears belong to art or marketing. But of course we will. We will analyze cadence, market the dimple, and nominate the sob. It's the only thing left to do now that we've outsourced the rest of life to streaming.
An ICE agent's cell phone gives us the kind of evidence this country now trusts. Shaky, incomplete, and perfectly framed to let power tell the story. The camera follows the agent as he walks around a stalled SUV, the driver visible in the window, the passenger holding up a phone, and a snarky remark about license plates. The clip ends with three gunshots, a camera jerk toward the sky, and an SUV lunging into a parked car. The rest, the question of whether the vehicle struck the agent, whether deadly force was necessary, remains just out of frame. This is what modern accountability looks like. A half minute of moving pixels, a family photo run through newsroom slides, a conservative outlet that first posts the clip, and a national politician who reposts it with a verdict. The Department of Homeland Security then issues a neat, airtight statement saying the footage confirms the agent feared for his life. The public gets to watch and make up its mind while the legal and moral fog thickens. There is a grim logic to it. Officers now carry cameras that record only what they choose to hold steady. Citizens are recorded by bystanders whose angles and interpretations vary. Every hastily released clip becomes a prop in a performance, proof to one side, proof of murder to the other, until the next viral fragment replaces it. Facts and feelings are edited down to what fits in a timeline and a political lane. The absurdism is thinly veiled. An agent who is supposed to protect and enforce the law films the exact moment he fires, hands steady enough to narrate his own defense. Officials then declare the footage vindication. That cycle normalizes a world where spills of violence are assessed by the same institutions that justify them, and society accepts a grainy video as the final courtroom of conscience. This is not an anomaly, it is a template. Cameras and statements, spun fast enough, let state power rename the violence it enacts. The clip is a record of one fatal encounter and a demonstration of how we will be asked to understand many more through curated fragments, immediate righteous spins, and an exhausted public asked to pass judgment on a loop.
From CNN, she bought a cheap home in Italy for the lifestyle, then her son's health dramatically improved. You buy a house for the view, the quiet, the idea of fewer things chasing you. Lynette Elser bought a house in Latronico for the lifestyle. She ended up buying a town-sized medical improvement plan that cost 50,000 euros and, inconveniently for the narrative of inevitability, actually worked. Her son Kenny, who struggled to breathe in Tennessee, found himself sleeping through the night in a village where cars are polite and the air does not pretend to be industrial. He went from oxygen dips and frantic monitors to steady readings above 95% because the place is high, clean, small, and apparently polite. The town rewarded him with pastries, nicknames, and a community that thinks handing out candy is a public health intervention. There's something quietly absurd about moving continents to stop a child from gasping. We fix our lives with purchases, a therapy gadget, a new mattress, a vacation home. Lynette purchased a refurbished upper story, then a lower story that used to house pigs and turned it into a life. She calls it quality of life. Italy calls it logistical paperwork and a passive income requirement that politely reminds you that freedom has an application fee. The irony stacks up like tiles on a freshly painted balcony. A depopulated Italian hill town offers houses for a pittance to lure people back. An American mother, exhausted by hospitals and bureaucracy, follows a headline and finds clean air and neighbors who say buono instead of what's your ROI. She trades a culture of complaints for one that applauds a new window. She leaves a place where progress meant more stuff and brings her son to a place where progress meant fewer things to make him choke. This is not a simple triumph of nature over medicine. It is a reminder that scale matters. Small towns have fewer smog machines and more human faces. Cities invented convenience and then sold us the consequences of that convenience. The market offered a modest, surprising remedy. Move to where the air doesn't hate you. There's a tenderness to it too. Shopkeepers giving candy, neighbors applauding tiles, a town welcoming an outsider with the casual generosity of people who know scarcity intimately. It is a practical kind of kindness, not the performative variety that funds feel-good ad campaigns. It also exposes a cold truth. Sometimes the cure for what ails us is not new technology or policy, but geography and slower schedules and carbs for breakfast. What do we do with that truth? We marvel, and we feel small, and maybe we laugh a little because the universe has a sense of humor. Global capitalism empties villages. Then global capitalism sells them back as affordable authenticity to people desperate for breath. We move, we patch up pigsties, we learn Italian, we enroll in school, and we become evidence that simple changes can outfox complex systems. In the end, Lynette didn't just buy a cheap house. She bought a place where a child can inhale without calculation. That's a strange economy. One where the currency is quiet, community, and air. It's a reminder that the world is less impressed by our cleverness than by whether we can sleep without panicking. And the rest of us keep building ever fancier problems that someday someone else will solve with a pastry and a thumbs up.
The capitalist fever dream, Donald Trump, reelected in 2024, traded the old dogmas of diplomacy for a simpler creed. Seize the stuff that still fuels profit. His capture of Nicolas Maduro wasn't about democracy or security. It was an auction house for black gold. Venezuela, sitting on more than 300 billion barrels, is the jackpot. The oil is also the mess. This isn't light crude you can pump and forget. It's heavy, sour crude, molasses thick, sulfur rich, and expensive to turn into anything useful. It needs steam, tons of energy, and mountains of natural gas just to move. The extraction process belches planet-heating emissions before a single gallon reaches a refinery. Refining it is dirtier too. Special equipment, more processing, more pollution. Call it dirty oil in both senses. Worse, the infrastructure is a rusting hazard. Pipelines leak. Flares roar. Methane, the short-term climate wrecking ball, pours out at 6 times the global average. Measured by emissions per barrel, Venezuelan production generates more than double the world norm. The country's own oil company stopped reporting spills years ago. Independent counts still found nearly 200 known spills between 2016 and 2021. And that's almost certainly an undercount. And yet the response from the top is not restraint, but investment begging. Bring in U.S. majors, throw cash at the wells, industrialize devastation. The companies might cut emissions here and there, but physics and degraded hardware set hard limits. Even with the best money can buy, you still burn a lot to get a little. Economics don't rescue the morality. Venezuela's production has collapsed from about 2 million barrels a day in 2016 to under 1 million now. Rebuilding and expanding production requires $53 billion just to stand still. $183 billion to chase past peaks. At a time the global market is flooded, prices limp, and demand growth is sputtering. It's a costly, high emissions bet on an outdated commodity. The deeper threat is political and psychological. Militarized grabs for toxic oil reroute public attention away from the energy transition and revive a century-old resource conflict playbook. Profiting from the dirtiest barrels while calling it progress is the epoch's signature hypocrisy. The fever dream is not that the oil will save anyone, it's that profit can paper over collapse. The rest of the world pays in hotter storms, fouled lands, and a delayed exit from the very system that brought this scramble to life.